From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Mike Pasca. USA Today's recent scoop about how three big phone companies were handing their customer call records over to the National Security Agency generated more headlines this week. Verizon said it had never been asked for the data and never provided it, and Bell South asked USA Today to retract its, quote, false and unsubstantiated statements. Also this week, in Senate confirmation hearings, Michael Hayden, who's nominated to head the CIA, insisted that the NSA programs are legal and necessary. And in other phone-tapping news, ABC News claimed that calls made by their reporters were being tracked. According to ABC, the government knew about calls placed by reporters Brian Ross and Richard Esposito. Ross, who is ABC's chief investigative correspondent, suspects the stories that put the feds on the telephone trail may have been their reporting on seven approved techniques for interrogation or their story on so-called black site prisons in Romania and Poland. But Ross never would have known if he hadn't received a call from someone in the know who rang with this warning.
This is a senior federal law enforcement official who told us, we know who you're calling. I've seen it. You should get some new cell phones quick. And that was essentially it.
Did he prove or she prove that they knew who you were calling by telling you who you were calling?
This person did cite one particular contact.
And that was a call you made, not a call to you?
Not a call to me. It was a call made by my colleague, Richard Esposito.
And from what you wrote, you made a distinction between tracking and backtracking. Just take us through it. What's the difference?
I asked another law enforcement official about this. And what he said was, well, you're wrong to say it's tracking. Think of it more as backtracking. And I said, what's the difference? He said, well, we're not watching you on a contemporaneous way, but if there is a referral for a criminal investigation into a leak of classified information, we go get phone records first from the government agency that might be involved. And then what they call the next logical investigative step, they go for reporters' records.
This story came out within a week of that USA Today story about a massive NSA data mining program.
Right.
Do you have any reason to believe the two things are connected?
I don't know. From what I know of the NSA program, my understanding is that really is looking at patterns of phone calls and does not look to detect individual contacts. And it wouldn't be that useful in a way because the information, as I understand it, that the NSA getting is sort of stripped of names and so on and is more really dedicated to determining patterns that connect overseas.
So if there's any connection, it may have something to do with just a different overall philosophy of government looking into people.
Right. Well, I think that you put your finger right on it. I think the connection, as it was described to me by one official, was this used to be difficult for us to go after reporters and their phone records. It no longer is hard. It's easy. We always get approval. The Justice Department guidelines provide for advanced approval from the Attorney General. And this person told me this is no longer a problem. It's not a problem to get approval to seek reporters' phone records.
Tell me a little bit about your standard operating procedure. When you hear from a confidential source, do you make it a point to say, you don't call me from work or I will call you? How do you usually do that?
Without giving away too much, I don't really obsess about that sort of thing. I guess I have assumed that whoever's calling me is doing in a way that is not traceable or at least deniable if they're caught out. A lot of people like to talk at home. Some talk in the office. Some only talk in person. Those are people who would not show up on our phone records.
How do you think of it now? You've been told you're being backtracked. Do you feel that you're being surveilled? Do you think about it that way?
I don't think of it that way. I think that any future stories about the CIA. Likely they will take my phone records and try to figure out who I was talking to. So what I'm changing and which Rich Esposito is changing, we're just going to have to use a lot more shoe leather.
Do you think if I look at your output over the next couple years, I'm going to be able to see any difference?
I think you'll see more, frankly. We're trying to stand up to this, and as a result, we are getting more leads.
Brian, thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you very much. It was great. Good talking to you.
Brian Ross is chief investigative correspondent for ABC News.
When Ross first revealed in his blog what he'd learned about his phone records, he said he didn't know if they were provided to the government as part of the NSA's recently disclosed program to gather all domestic call records. It turned out it was the FBI. But journalist and defense analyst Bill Arkin says Ross should have known that. A leak investigation is different from the domestic data trawling reported in USA Today, and it's also different from the tracking of international calls for keywords, which made headlines last December in the New York Times. Arkin wrote in the Washington Post online this week that he was concerned about the creation of what he called a seamless surveillance culture, but he was also worried about reporters who muddied the waters by lumping all such programs together. And he suggested that journalists' obsession with their phone records bordered on narcissism. Now, Arkin has spent much of his own career publishing secret information from well-placed government sources and is a prime target for just the sort of investigation that Ross complained of. So we wondered why he was so exasperated with his colleagues. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Brooke.
Anybody hearing about federal law enforcement officials keeping tallies on reporters' calls is going to think immediately of the various NSA programs we've been hearing about lately. Is that a fair leap to make?
Well, first of all, it's an unfair leap to think that the federal government is listening in on reporters' calls or keeping track of them. If there is veracity behind Brian Ross's story, then it is because retrospectively, as part of the leak investigation, they can look at who they spoke to. And if those people are stupid enough to speak to reporters on their official phones or over their official email, then they are going to be caught. So to conflate that with contemporaneous monitoring of reporters' phone calls, which would require a warrant, it would require a criminal investigation even more, I think would be a grave error.
Now, you wrote in a column this week that there is no enemies list. What were you responding to?
You know, I think that the whole public assumption about these NSA revelations is that they somehow are the tip of the iceberg of a new Nixonian enemies list, that they're politically motivated and that reporters and political people are the target. What I'm urging people to understand in order to understand these programs is that they have to see it through a 21st century lens and not a 1960s lens. Think of it in your own lives. There has been an explosion of communications from instant messaging to text messaging over telephones to the explosion of cell phones themselves, etc. There has just been an exponential growth in the signals environment, and it happens to correspond more or less with 2000, 2001 to the present. So there is something that has changed in the world that even if there weren't a war on terrorism, the monitors, the NSA people, would be out there scratching their heads saying, wow, there's so many more communications here. How do we tease out of it the intelligence information of value? And it might appear that we should just see it once again as some Nixonian enemies list accumulating in the bowels of the White House. But I think the truth of the matter is that what we are seeing is a 21st century struggle to keep up with a vastly exploding communications environment.
Do you completely then discount the views of those who say, look, the government may now be assembling this data, these tools, to track our enemies, but it can also use it to track its enemies, which could be reporters, critics, people from the other party. I mean, that is Nixonian. If Nixon had these tools, that's how he'd use them.
Well, I think if we can imagine that the government is building a capacity for monitoring, that looks like the capacity that exists in Hollywood. With a few strokes of the keyboard and the use of the mouse, I can tell you who you are, where you are today, what you had for breakfast, and the name of your dog. If you imagine that that's what's going on, then of course it looks like the president and the government is building a magnificent mechanism for domestic repression. They are so far away from being there, Brooke. They are not anywhere close to that capacity. But it's not to say that they're not trying. It's not to say that we're not spending billions of dollars a year on these pattern recognition and data mining programs in which they are trying to crunch vast amounts of information. And with that capacity, we are building a seamless surveillance culture in which the possibility of government abuse in the future is there.
And why are you telling us then to calm down?
I'm telling you that we should understand what the real problem is. The real problem is not that Brian Ross's phone calls are being monitored. The real problem is that the changes in the nature of intelligence collection, bolstered by these greater freedoms that the White House wants to take as a result of 9/11, have challenged us to come up with new laws, new congressional oversight, new understandings of privacy and civil liberties, and there isn't a person who seems to be able to approach this in a nonpartisan, reasonable way.
In a follow-up on its big story last week, USA Today reported that two-thirds of Americans are concerned that the NSA call tracking program may just be the tip of the iceberg and that there may be other, as yet undisclosed, spying programs on American citizens. Are you among that two-thirds?
I'm not concerned that there are undisclosed programs that are spying on normal Americans. I'm concerned that two-thirds of Americans are so confused about what it is that the government is doing and what it is that the government can do within the limits of the law. That's what I'm concerned about, is that the American public needs to be completely on board with what it is that its government is doing. It's not going to get on board, however, if we overstate what it is that the government is doing, if we mischaracterize what it is that the government is doing, or if we accept that the government, in fact, knows what it's doing and is doing something useful, and we should just shut up and go home because it's men's work. The reality here, Brooke, is that I don't know whether or not this is useful or useless. But the only way we're going to find out is by not overstating either the gravity of the situation or the importance of the intelligence.
All right. Bill, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, Brooke.
Bill Arkin writes the Early Warning column at WashingtonPost.com.
Coming up, Hot in Hollywood, sequels, Kabbalah, and the average temperature of the Earth.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca. This week brought reports that six members of an Indonesian family may have been killed by avian flu. That would bring the total number of deaths to 121. Not this year, not in Indonesia, but worldwide ever. The number may not seem huge, but public health officials are quick to remind us that there is the potential risk that avian flu, if it mutates, could rival the 1918 pandemic that killed some 30 to 40 million people. Potential risk. That's a phrase you've probably heard 1,000 or so times in stories about avian flu or mad cow or West Nile or smallpox. These diseases all carry a potential risk, fair enough. But if risk is something bad that could happen, what's a potential risk? Something bad that could happen? Mark Siegel is a practicing internist and a professor of medicine at the New York University Medical School. He's a man who takes health risks seriously, but he's also on guard against a false alarm, which is the title of a book he's authored, subtitled The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. Welcome to On the Media, Dr. Siegel.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about the biggest fear du jour. And right now, everyone's talking about bird flu. There's an ABC movie of the week, and the World Health Organization says bird flu could kill 150 million people. What do you say?
Well, Mike, I think fear is supposed to be a warning system against imminent danger. And I think by always talking in doom and gloom terms, we send the public the message that something is about to happen. By doing that, we blur a lot of steps that would have to occur first. This current virus that we're obsessing over, the H5N1 virus, appears to be multiple mutations away from being able to pass easily human to human and even cause a pandemic. Secondly, we don't know what the effect is of modern technology on this virus if it ever did cross the species barrier. Look, when a disease is new, when it's just coming out, it's normal for people to be afraid of it. That doesn't mean, though, that the bird flu is more of an imminent risk than something like tuberculosis, malaria, HIV/AIDS has killed 3.1 million people this year. I don't think we should take the eye off those balls.
Now, I want to be clear. Do you think you and the epidemiologists who study bird flu every day actually disagree on what the potential for risk is?
I think the answer to that is that the actual risk itself is always evolving. I mean, we found out over a year ago that this particular virus was similar in structure from the 1918 virus. That was worth being concerned about. But here's what we found out since then. Two studies that came out last month showed that it's multiple mutations away from being able to cross the species barrier. Another researcher looked at trying to manipulate it with similar genes from the 1918 virus, and he wasn't able to get it to take in human lung tissue. The other problem is we already have other viruses out there, flu viruses that do go human to human, and they could mutate while we're so focused on this one.
In Slate, Greg Easterbrook wrote a column that was basically in agreement with your basic point, but he did say that there's a justifiable reason for hype around bird flu. And this is what he said the justifiable reason was. Recent experience shows pushing the panic button is an effective way to prevent a disease from taking hold. Well, if that's the case, is it really so bad if we push the panic button perhaps unnecessarily every now and again?
I saw Greg's article in Slate and I thought it was excellent, but I actually not sure that I agree that pushing the panic button helps. I mean, you take some recent examples like SARS. I don't think that there's any evidence that pushing the panic button on SARS did more than spend billions of dollars around the world, cost us money in terms of tourism, in terms of the Asian and Toronto economies. Now, what it did do, and this is a positive thing, I think it caused countries to work more closely at reporting cases and isolating sick people, because that's a really important thing that infectious disease has to do. That doesn't mean, though, that they somehow snuffed SARS and that they should take credit for it, because there's no evidence of that. It looks like SARS wasn't as infectious as we thought it was.
This show has documented how journalists don't speak science so much. But what can journalists do? Can journalists push back against the World Health Organization?
It means asking very smart questions to your officials that are giving their opinion. I think in bird flu, it's officials that have caused the hype and the hysteria even more than the media has in this case. We have to learn a new language of how to communicate risk so that we can say to the public, look, this is something we have to be concerned about and take seriously, but there is nothing imminent here. We seem to lose the last half of that sentence.
Have you seen similarities or differences between, say, how America reports these risks and how Western Europe reports these risks?
You know, Mike, in the post-9/11 world, we here in America became very vulnerable. We felt susceptible. We were psychically wounded. We panic at the very first thing that comes along. Anthrax, we overreacted to 22 cases, and we all were afraid to open our mail. Then we were afraid of smallpox, which hasn't been here since the 1940s. You know, then it was SARS. I think with those issues, Europe and the rest of the world was not reacting to the same extent. But more recently, I mean, the media in Europe, I've looked at it very closely, and there's been a great deal of panic and overreaction to bird flu, which has led in part to the fear of poultry in Europe, even though there wasn't a single human case. This seems to have toned down, and I think that there's a more consistent message out there of let's inform you but be more cautious about it. So there was a huge difference initially after 9/11, but right now it's been fairly similar around the world.
Well, Dr. Mark Siegel, thanks very much.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Mark Siegel is the author of False Alarm, The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear and Bird Flu, Everything You Need to Know About the Next Pandemic.
If the threat posed by bird flu is overhyped, then what about climate change? For years, news reports played the threat down by playing up the impression that the jury was still out on the causes of global warming, not to mention its effects down the road. But lately, at least in the pages of the American press, we see more and more signs of impending apocalypse. Polar bears drowning in Alaska, hurricanes intensifying, record-breaking temperatures. Be worried, be very worried, warned a recent Time magazine cover. And this Wednesday, select theaters premiere An Inconvenient Truth, the new documentary about Al Gore's climate crusade.
I am Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America. This is Patagonia, 75 years ago, and the same glacier today. This is Mount Kilimanjaro, 30 years ago, and last year, within the decade. There will be no more Snows of Kilimanjaro.
If you take climate change seriously, you might think that all the recent media is good news. But New York Times science writer Andrew Revkin isn't entirely thrilled. He's covered climate change for more than two decades, during which he's noticed a pattern of playing up the spectacle at the expense of the science.
When you start focusing on the things that are happening in the here and now world, like hurricanes, my God, it doesn't get any more vivid than that. So you're really... every bone in your journalistic body is trying to find that link. Where's the front page thought here? And the front page thought is clearly that global warming has somehow juiced up last year's hurricane season specifically in a way that is our fault. You get into this realm where there is legitimate debate still in the science, and you move away from the things that no one disputes, that these gases like carbon dioxide trap the sun's heat, they're warming the climate, and they will warm the climate more in coming years.
You say the fact that CO2 is building up in the atmosphere is now beyond doubt. What is still dubious?
Well, the debate now is about how fast consequences will play out. Whether sea level rises 2 or 3 feet in each century is different than if it rises, let's say, 10 feet in one century. When you look ahead at the Arctic, later this century, there's not a scientist around studying this stuff who doesn't see the prospect of basically a blue pole at the top of the world for the first time in human history. Meaning summertime, open water ocean, just like the Atlantic or the Pacific, all the ice gone. But when you look at the near term, there's been a lot of melting, a lot of strange things going on with the sea ice. They can't ascribe this particular year to our influence on the climate system. They know it's contributing to change, but there's enough variability in the Arctic that you can't make a slam dunk case. But that's a nightmare for the media. You know, my editors, the one thing that makes them glaze over immediately is the word incremental. That's like at the Times, and I'm sure any other newsroom, that's a death sentence for a story. And global warming is kind of like the Social Security and national debt of the environment. It's there. We all recognize it's some kind of big bad thing, but it's always kind of a someday somewhere story.
And there's something else they have in common. No good pictures.
Yeah, that's right.
You can photograph dead birds in an oil spill. You can photograph the destruction of the rainforest.
Even the ozone hole, the atmospheric problem that we grew up with in the 80s, had a clear, glaring symbol, this sort of purple bruise in the atmosphere over Antarctica.
And easy to identify bad guys,
right.
Just those people who produced chlorofluorocarbons.
Right, right. A very different kind of problem. And it's very easy to cast an administration or industry as the bad guy here. It's much harder to realize that this buildup of these greenhouse gases is caused by every single thing we do in modern life. Building a new power plant, turning on a car, it's hard to think, oh, we're the bad guy. That doesn't make for such a convenient story either. Many people out there, including many scientists I talked to, are incredibly frustrated that the scientists have not been able to kind of explain this situation in a way that galvanizes a big public response. And so this is almost a natural reaction to kind of reach out, to grasp a little farther toward the thing in the here and now world that might make it a media story or might get people's attention. This can backfire. You get into a realm where there's enough debate that opponents of action on global warming can jump right in and say you're just fear-mongering.
And as we've said on this show, there are efforts on the part of industry to exploit the journalistic practice of offering balance, the he said, she said kind of argument, in order to play up the idea of uncertainty where it might not exist.
In fact, in the Times in 1998, Jack Cushman, a colleague of mine, revealed a document that essentially was the game plan of the energy lobbies to fight greenhouse gas restrictions. And it expressly laid out a budget and how to hire some scientists to train them to speak about uncertainty and get out there in the mix.
And we have a quote from that memo here. Victory will be achieved when uncertainties in climate science become part of the conventional wisdom. We also have a tape that was launched just this week by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a libertarian group backed by ExxonMobil. Let's listen to that.
Greenland's glaciers are growing, not melting. Did you see any big headlines about that? Why are they trying to scare us? Global warming alarmists claim the glaciers are melting because of carbon dioxide from the fuels we use. Let's force people to cut back, they say. But we depend on those fuels to grow our food, move our children, light up our lives. And as for carbon dioxide, it isn't smog or smoke. It's what we breathe out and plants breathe in. Carbon dioxide. They call it pollution. We call it life.
So, Andrew, I have to ask you, why do you hate children and plants?
Well, nobody hates children and plants. And carbon dioxide is and has always been a component of the atmosphere. But we're doubling the amount from what was there before industry got busy and before we got busy 150 years ago burning coal and oil. And there's, again, a huge body of evidence that that's leading to a world that will be a very different place than we are familiar with. This is the breaking news. The breaking news is humans are transforming the way the world works.
And it's the breaking news today, tomorrow, next week, next month, and for the end of the century, and for half of the previous century.
It's breaking news in terms of the scope of the history of human life on Earth, right, which is, for most people, a snooze. I guess it gets down to what is journalism about. I do think there's a part of journalism that needs to explore the things that don't necessarily fit our norms. In other words, let's, for the moment, leave aside the things at the edges of the science that are compelling and weird and scary, but that we don't really understand very well, and get back to the bedrock. This is what carbon dioxide does. More of it will make the world warmer. A warmer world will have less ice. That will make seas higher, and that will lead to profound transformations that we need to pay attention to. And if it takes writing a story that way, where you literally start the lead of the story, this isn't a story as we know it, but this is a story. Let me tell you why. I think that's that could work.
Maybe once.
I think basically, you know, well, maybe once. I mean, maybe it means that in this 21st century world, the front page needs to evolve a little bit.
All right. Thank you very much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Andrew Revkin covers climate science and policy for the New York Times. His new book is called The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World.
That's global warming in the news pages. But lately, that's not the only media space being given over to this hot topic. Here are the guys from South Park.
Within the hour, the temperature outside will fall to over 70 million degrees below zero. Jesus. All we can do is try to wait it out as long as we can.
When global warming pops up in an unexpected place, look for Lori David somewhere behind the scenes. David is an environmental activist and a co-producer of An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's film. After the last presidential election, David decided to take out her Rolodex and tackle global warming her way. With media savvy and Hollywood connections, she set out to make global warming a pop culture phenomenon.
We did a primetime television special on TBS in November. And we had every major top comedian. We had Tom Hanks and Will Ferrell and Ben Stiller and my husband, Larry David. And they were all on the show, and they all did comedy pieces on global warming.
I think the polar ice caps suck. Who cares about having a place where a bunch of penguins can have an orgy?
Now, because of that show, Good Morning America did their first segment on the morning show on the issue, and they used the Earth to America as the reason for doing like 7 minutes on global warming. Because of Earth to America, Oprah Winfrey did her first show in 20 years on an environmental issue, and it was on global warming. This is just my little niche. I come out of the media. I'm particularly lucky. I have a well-known husband who has helped me have this platform, and I'll be the first to use it if it means getting the message out.
I wanted to ask you about your husband, who is the producer and the star of Curb Your Enthusiasm and was also the co-creator of Seinfeld. Obviously, you have a lot of passion for the issue. Does he ever say to you, honey, I know where you're coming from, but you know what? Just not that funny. I mean, I'll drive a different car, but I'm not going to weave it into the storyline.
Listen, I have pushed this relationship to the edge, and it's a miracle we're still together, to tell you the truth. Because now,
but does he argue on that particular point?
He's first and foremost a comedian, so you're completely right. The problem is he lives in this house, and he's kind of have to get along with me. You know, he doesn't give me credit, though, for the reason why he's driving the hybrid car, the Prius, on Curb Your Enthusiasm. He doesn't give me the credit. He says he bought it because it had the legroom he likes for his knee.
She did not influence that decision at all. I like to stick my right knee out all the way to the right, and that car was the only car I found that didn't have a console that allowed me to stick my knee out.
I obviously have influenced the guy, let's face it.
Here's a quote that you said on the website The Huffington Post, and you were talking about seeing the movie Ice Age 2. You wrote, there's no better way to educate the public than doing it without them knowing. Do you really think that's true?
Well, I mean, that goes to comedy and using comedy, because comedy, you know, is really based in truth. I think when all the late night comedians start doing top 10 lists on, you know, top 10 reasons why global warming exists, or top 10 things George Bush is not doing to stop global warming, that's a very powerful thing.
Top 10 signs there actually is global warming. Here's Tom Hanks, number 10.
I just bought oceanfront property in Topeka, Kansas.
There you go. How about that? Topeka, Kansas.
You're basically getting a message out to the American people without, you know, hammering it on their head.
I know that you have a heavy influence on what your husband drives on his show, but there is a very popular show called ER. The co-creator of that is Michael Crichton, and he's one of the biggest, I guess you could call him a global warming denier in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, if you bring your force to bear on the issue, and if he does his, is there going to be an arms race?
No, because first of all, you call him a denier, which he is, but I call him a nutcase. You know, what's dangerous about Michael Crichton and really criminal about what he's done is that he's professing to, you know, be speaking from science, and he's not speaking from science. He's a science fiction writer.
Well, you can influence a show and get a global warming message in there, but, you know, he can influence a show and get a message that would drive you crazy into his show. Maybe at some point it's better not to take these, if you want to call them works of art, as means of getting a message to the public. Maybe it's better to just back off and let the shows be the shows and let the message be the message.
Well, I think entertainment would be very dull indeed if it didn't take on the issues of the day. What makes music so powerful and movies so powerful is the fact that they are, you know, reflecting what's happening today. They're relevant, and they're critical. So I encourage more of it.
Thank you very much, Lori David, global warming activist. Thank you, Lori.
Mike, thanks so much for having me on. And everybody go to stopglobalwarming.org.
Coming up, documentarians struggle with the concept of fair use and find it's unfair how much they can't use.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. On the Media is supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On May 25th, Live from Lincoln Center broadcasts 30 years of Live from Lincoln Center, featuring clips from artists who have appeared on Lincoln Center's stages. Check local PBS listings. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Mike Pasca.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Late last month, New York University's Institute for the Humanities hosted a symposium titled The Comedies of Fair Use. Simply put, fair use is a legal principle that allows copyrighted material to be used within reason without permission from or payment to the owner. But the symposium, with its guest artists, authors, musicians, filmmakers, and academics, demonstrated just how difficult it is to know what constitutes fair use. In a moment, we'll hear from law professors who study copyright, but first, a few war stories from the trenches. Amy Sewell is the producer and writer of the documentary Mad Hot Ballroom, which follows neighborhood kids from New York City through intensive dance lessons. Her movie was released last year, and she joins me now. Amy, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me, Brooke.
So it's nearly impossible to walk down the street in New York City without encountering a logo or a photo or a song that isn't copyrighted. But you never imagined that you'd wind up in a legal negotiation with the label EMI. Start from the beginning and tell us what happened.
Within the movie Mad Hot Ballroom, which is about 11-year-old's journey into the world of ballroom dancing in New York City public schools, we had to clear over 20 songs for the movie. One of them was in a scene where a little boy from Bensonhurst, Michael, and his mother are walking down the street. And during this scene, which is just being shot as is, normal daily life, his mother's cell phone rings. And the tune is Gonna Make You Fly from the hit movie, Rocky. And she answers her phone. It was 6 seconds. With every song, you have to clear two sides to the music. One is the master, which Sprint owned, and they gave us permission to use it for free. But then you also have to clear the publishing rights. And that side was owned by EMI. And I think they started around $10,000 for those 6 seconds. And we kept negotiating them down. And eventually we ended up getting it for $2,500. I call it my $2,500 laugh in the movie. And I laugh very, very hard every time I see it.
Trying to amortize the cost of the $2,500 use. Now, we should stipulate that Mad Hot Ballroom is a documentary. It isn't a fictional film. It wasn't your choice to put Rocky in there. But once that cell phone rang, you felt you had to use it. Why?
That was a part in the movie that I just thought really showed a relationship between a son and a mother, what's happening in today's society with mothers and their cell phones, and also the humor behind it that they are Italian from an Italian neighborhood, and it was the theme song from Rocky.
So Rocky stayed in, but another reference to a pop song went out. You decided not to pay for that one.
Yes, that was a scene where the three boys from Bensonhurst were in the basement playing foosball. And young Ronnie belts out Everybody Dance Now without any tune or musical chords behind him or in his voice.
Everybody Dance Now, you mean like Everybody Dance Now from the CNC Music Factory?
Exactly. And I'm glad you're singing it and not me. So it's from CNC Music Factory, and that's actually called a visual vocal cue. And Warner Chappell wanted $10,000 for that.
$10,000 for a kid saying, not even singing, Everybody Dance Now?
For three words. And we got him down to $5,000, but they had reminded me that they'd been very good to us with a couple other songs, so we let it go. But I think what's really kind of frightening is that as a documentarian, and again, I think of documentarians as journalists, you can't control what people say, and you shouldn't have to. It ceases to be a documentary. I'll give you one more example that falls into this strange kind of category. In our film, the little team from Bensonhurst, PS112, we show them playing in a band. And it's funny because they really can't play that well. And you can't really recognize that song. It's undefinable. Somebody out there is saying that that's their song, and we're saying, well, what song is it? Have we copyrighted every single sound that will be headed back to silent movies so we won't have to worry about any of this?
So let's say that you poured your heart and soul into a documentary and somebody else took it, reassembled it in a way that completely betrayed the principles that you felt the film had, and they say, well, hey, it's fair use. Do you just grin and bear it? Do you see the other side at all?
I do see the other side. In fact, at this conference at NYU, I was asked if somebody had taken Mad Hot Ballroom and put it out there in a way that was not flattering to some of the children. How would I feel about that? And of course, it would kill me, and I don't think I would sit back and not say anything. I would probably reach inside and find out how I feel and then speak out. But, you know, fair use is fair speech, and any form of censorship, I think, is not a good thing.
Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Sewell is the producer and writer of the documentary Mad Hot Ballroom. Her stories are enough to put a scare not only in aspiring filmmakers, but it turns out even law professors. Fordham University's Hugh Hansen is an advocate of strong copyright laws. He's what you might call a high protectionist. But even he concedes that for low-budget filmmakers, the system can be more of a burden than a blessing. He joins us now, along with James Boyle, who teaches law at Duke University. According to Boyle, copyright holders have in recent years ushered in what he calls a permissions culture, ignoring the laws on fair use. That 6 seconds ringtone that went off in Mad Hot Ballroom, Boyle says that's a legal no-brainer.
That's the question on the exam, that if you get that wrong, the professor's going to fail you. Of course it's a fair use. It's a classic fair use. It's too easy a question. So it's not so much the law. I think it's the culture around the law.
What is the permissions culture?
The permissions culture is the assumption that you have to pay for every fragment of copyrighted material wherever it appears, whether in a movie or in any other context, that the rights holder gets to control every use, no matter how tiny, no matter how fleeting, no matter how accidental. That's, in the context of documentary film, what the permissions culture is.
I'll turn to Hugh now. You know, it's only recently that copyright holders started demanding payment for short, incidental uses of their work, like a television program playing in the background, or, to use another of Amy Sewell's examples, a child blurting out 3 words that were recognizable as lyrics to a song. Is that, in fact, the law?
It is not the law. And so what we have now is a situation where I think it may have started with the movie industry, perhaps their insurance. They would clear rights for things they did not have to clear. And a very big budget film, the clearing of the rights was rather a small thing, and they just did it to make everyone happy. The industries involved got used to being asked for everything, and it almost became a custom with them. And now they simply are applying old custom rules, which are not backed up by the law.
And that's, I think, one of the real outrages here. Filmmakers need to get what's called errors and omissions insurance in order to put their movies on, if you want to distribute your movie and not just show it to your mother. And errors and omissions insurers say you have to clear it. It's in their interest to be relatively conservative. And, you know, if this were just another business, if they were just making sausages, we might say, well, you know, this is just the cost of doing business that we have these intermediaries who are maybe unduly conservative. But the point is, if you're actually making the records of our culture, of our history, which is what documentaries are, then having a set of assumptions that you have to clear everything, it can really produce a kind of censorship, a kind of unwillingness to let the camera cover anything that could touch a piece of copyrighted culture, a piece of music, a bit of a movie, a bit of a TV show. You could film nudity, you could film violence, you could film armed conflict.
But a Simpsons character, you better watch out.
Forget it. I mean, that just exposes the ludicrousness of this. And also, that's potentially quite harmful.
So what is the law?
The law says that you can use fragments of copyrighted material for a variety of purposes, including news reporting, commentary, criticism. There are 4 factors that the fair use section sets out. And it's pretty clear that documentaries, particularly in these cases of kind of accidental capture, that the law is completely on their side, that what they're doing is they're not replacing a market for the work. They're just taking a tiny fragment that happened to be in their shot.
Now, Hugh, you tend toward high protectionism. There was a conference on copyright a few weeks back. I know that you heard a bunch of horror stories along with James. When you hear those stories from artists and filmmakers, does it lead you to conclude that the law needs reform, or does something else need to be done?
No, I think the law is actually probably pretty good on these issues. And in many situations in life where there's a disparity in income, and people who don't have money can't actually get the legal help to exercise their rights. We've done things like provided legal aid on a civil side, legal aid on a criminal side. I think that's what we should really be looking at, ways in which people can get access to legal assistance. And I think once they get access to legal assistance, I think the problem will largely go away, because people are not going to sue for the amount of money that would be involved with any of these independent filmmakers. Frankly, I think we need a few test cases.
And there have been some cases. There was the case of the independent filmmaker who did a film parodying the image of Barbie. Mattel took them to court and lost. George of the Jungle, the movie, used the caterpillar tractors to take down part of the rainforest. Caterpillar took that to court. Caterpillar lost. But you think we need test cases beyond that?
Yeah, I think we do. Or at least we need people willing to bring test cases. And that, I think, will force people in industry to rethink what they're doing.
I think Hugh's absolutely right. I think that's what we've got to do on one end. But I think you have to also work on the other end, the pre-production end. Because there's another problem here, which is an increasing unwillingness of filmmakers ever to get this kind of material into their viewfinders in the first place. A remarkable state of ignorance about what the law permits. Just incredible situations where people were telling me, well, of course, I know I'm not allowed to show the logo on people's hats when I'm filming them. And this makes any intellectual property lawyer just kind of like roll his eyes and go, what are you talking about? Of course you are. So I think we also need to focus on the front end, on education, on reaching people who may be producing in non-conventional means, who may not have access to lawyers, and to help explain to them what the rules actually are. Because I agree with you. I think the rules are pretty good. I don't think the rules do need to be changed.
Well, what do you disagree about?
Well, I can take a stab at that and Hugh can correct me. I think Hugh tends to see copyright as a kind of a Lockean thing, as a reward in part for labor. And I tend to see it more as, in fact, that the real goal of the copyright system in many cases is to feed stuff into the public domain, to get the person who's creating to create it and the distributor to distribute it. And then as soon as possible, ideally under very short copyright terms, to get that material out there for everyone to reuse, change, adapt, make their own versions of. And I think Hugh's vision, I think, sort of starts from a different set of premises and so comes to a different set of conclusions.
Well, I guess I am Lockean. I think most people in this country are Lockean and I'm not read Locke. It's not like copyright is this rigid cage which prohibits people from building on something what someone else did. I think there's flexibility in the system. Music, for instance, architecture, choreography. There's constant use of what went before, and copyright's been okay with it. But if you have too much flexibility in a system, you don't have a system anymore. And when you need protection, you don't get it. And if you're an artist, you want some autonomy and control over your work. And it's important not to trash the system because there are abuses of the system. And simply, the abuses, I think, are getting worse.
I like to say that the great thing about how extreme copyright culture is nowadays is that the assertions which are being made by copyright holders are so stupid that everyone is coming to agree on them. And I think
even Hugh.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
James Boyle is a professor of law at Duke University and co-author of Bound by Law, a comic book about fair use, available for free on the Duke Law School website. Hugh Hansen is a founder of an annual conference on intellectual property and professor of law at Fordham University.
Was this the face that launched 1,000 ships?
Today, we end with the bard. Or at least a bard. Because that was Christopher Marlowe writing about Helen of Troy. This is Shakespeare writing about Helen of Troy.
She is a pearl whose price hath launched above 1,000 ships.
Marlowe.
Holla, ye pampered jades of Asia. What, can ye draw but 20 miles a day?
Shakespeare.
And hollow pampered jades of Asia, which cannot go but 30 miles a day.
Marlowe died before any of those Shakespearean plays were written. Some people, such as the producers of the PBS special from which those clips were lifted, have concluded that the similarities mean Shakespeare was Marlowe. The less radical interpretation is that Shakespeare was a plagiarist. Such a charge in Elizabethan England would result in scratched heads, and not just because of the prevalence of lice. Back then, plagiarism was no big deal. Fair was foul and foul was fair, as Shakespeare probably stole from Ben Jonson. Aristotle stole from Democritus. Homer stole from folklore. Virgil stole from Homer. The point is, getting one's papyrus in a twist over plagiarism is a relatively recent phenomenon. This week alone, University of Colorado professor and 9/11 victim antagonist Ward Churchill was found to be a plagiarist. And an NBC producer writing about the Kentucky Derby stole not just a phrase, but the idea of repeating the phrase after a pause. after a pause. Of course, the most picked-over case is that of Harvard freshman Kava Viswanathan, who got $500,000 for writing How Opal Mehta Got Kissed, Got Wild, and Got a Life, a book that had the unfortunate quality of having already been written, a reading from Megan McCafferty's Sloppy Seconds.
But in a truly sadomasochistic dieting gesture, they chose to buy their Diet Cokes at Cinnabon.
And from Opal Mehta.
In a truly masochistic gesture, they had decided to buy Diet Cokes from Mrs. Fields.
As a truly sadomasochistic gesture, I can read to you a couple dozen more of those parallelisms, but then I'd ruin the literary experience. Suffice it to say, the outrage against the teenaged author was swift and furious, and deservedly so. She, James Fry, Jason Blair, cheats and liars all, a pox on all their houses. Shakespeare, but probably also John Webster. Of course, journalists who have bylines tend to be more aggrieved by instances of plagiarism than the layman. The consumer probably has an Elizabethan mindset about all this. No big deal. Because when you think about it, how can the layman possibly keep up? Can he watch a TV report and definitively say it was written by the on-screen correspondent or by an off-screen producer? Can he watch a movie and be sure the credited screenwriter wrote the lines? Or was it one of the dozen scribes who punch up every script? And that DJ's beat, his own, or a Casey and the Sunshine Band track from the 70s? None of those things are theft, but it convinces the consumer that a byline might just be a vestige of a bygone era. The last big institution holding the line against plagiarism is the Academy. Doris Kearns Goodwin seriously hurt her status as a historian when she plagiarized, but as a television commentator and author of page-turning biographies, we can forgive her trespasses, to quote the King James Bible, which was written by a team of writers stealing from God. I predict that in 20 years, whatever version there is of Wikipedia will refer to plagiarism as a short-lived concept in the history of communication. Eventually, the open source reference guide will say, plagiarism, once seen as a dire pitfall, came to be discounted as a sin. Eventually, plagiarists were treated like hack comics. You can steal a joke, but you can't steal a career. And you can quote me on that. Or feel free to pass the thought on as your own, especially if I'm wrong. And that's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ani Katz and Mark Phillips. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca. Bob Garfield will be back next week.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. On the Media is supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On May 25th, Live from Lincoln Center broadcasts 30 years of Live from Lincoln Center, featuring clips from artists who have appeared on Lincoln Center's stages. Check local PBS listings. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.